Thank you, France. Good to be here. France also signed the Baltimore Charter for Women in Astronomy, along with about 150 other people, and so far we're still waiting for the fame and the fortune to follow from that. I don't know. Someday. Okay, but my topic today is blazars, and so my plan is to tell you what they are, explain what jets have to do with blazars, and then tell you a little bit about the galaxies they sit in, and at the end, I hope you'll see how they, I see some familiar faces, how they connect to normal galaxies. So just before I start, let me just take a poll here. So how many people know what blazars are or think they know? Okay, good. So please jump in with questions. I didn't bring my little quiz because I didn't figure there'd be a lot of students, darn it. I should have brought my quiz, but all right. Ask questions if you have any. Here's an outline of the talk, okay?
You know, I tell my students, I say, always wear something with a pocket and, you know, come prepared for mics. Could I just speak loudly without this, do you think? Oh, I'm being recorded.
Oh. You ain't nothing but a... I feel like I should break into song, you know? Like Elvis. All right, let's try this again. I'm sorry for the distraction. Okay, properties of blazars, the fact that they're relativistically beamed, and how that unifies AGN. AGN are active galactic nuclei, so I'll tell you what those are too. I'm going to say one or two words about resolved jets in the optical and X-ray, because there are some very nice results coming out, but it's just more like an ad than a real part of the talk. And then most of the talk is about two topics, the emission from unresolved jets, the inner high-energy emitting region of the jet, and then the host galaxies, a big project that my group has recently finished and which I think has some very interesting results. So first of all, active galactic nuclei are galaxies with a massive black hole in the center which is converting accreting matter into luminous energy somehow by magic. And one hope is to figure out what that magic is at some point, but we're not there yet. Okay, blazars are a particular kind of AGN, and they're defined observationally by these characteristics. They're extremely rapidly variable. Yeah, thanks. Oh, bamboo. How California. This is really great. Okay. This is so the speaker cannot get mean with the audience, because this wouldn't really do much. Okay. They're rapidly variable. They're extremely luminous, or they appear extremely luminous. The emission is highly polarized. They have very high brightness temperatures, meaning they're extremely compact. And they have enormous changes of luminosity in very short times, which is hard to explain, as I'll show in a second. And they're superluminal. So let me show some examples of these qualities. You can see I'm going to be dancing. First of all, rapid variability. This is kind of an extreme example, but not too bad. Sorry, Lars. This is a gamma ray light curve of a particular blazar, 1622 plus something something, I don't remember the name, and this is the flux in certain units, and over a period of about 40 days, which is the typical length of an observation with EGRIT, because EGRIT, an experiment on the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, had to look usually for 1 or 2 weeks to even detect any of these extragalactic objects. It was not extremely sensitive. But it was looking at this particular blazar one day, which was sort of mucking along at a few hundred counts per second in these units, And it goes up to by a factor of 20 in a period of, and back down in a period of a couple days. So this is pretty extreme variability. And you normally would deduce that the object, which is varying that rapidly, must be less than a light day in size, because otherwise the whole thing couldn't get that bright and go back down in that short a time. So this was an extreme example, and at its peak, the luminosity from the apparent luminosity from this blazar is something like all the light of 1,000 galaxies, 100,000 galaxies, but smashed into a region, something like a light day across. So kind of stretching the physical possibilities. That's what that kind of variability, perhaps not that extreme, but that kind of variability is what brought blazars to our attention initially.
This is another example of a different blazar. This is 3C279. It's a quasar, which is known to be a superluminal source. I'll show you in a second. But here's a gamma ray light curve on the top and an X-ray light curve on the bottom. And you can see, again, they both go up at the same time. The X-rays vary by a factor of 3, the gamma rays by about a factor of 10, and they go together in a period of a few days. This is, again, 20 days across the board. So this is pretty typical of blazars. I said they were also superluminal sources, meaning they move faster than the speed of light, which everybody knows can't be true. So, but anyway, let me show you how it looks first. This is a map. These are radio maps of the center of 3C279 over a period of 10 years, and time runs down in this plot. So you see the map in 1984, and here it's in 1994, and you can see that this blob is moving outward from the center. And if you measure how far it moves, this being about 100 light years, you can see it moves some fraction of that in a period of 10 years. And if you work it out, the speed is about 10 times the speed of light. So that could be a problem, but luckily, an old friend, Einstein, this is the young Einstein and his wife, Mileva Maric, who apparently, she was a mathematician, a Serb from Novi Sad. Evidently, she helped him on this problem. But anyway, he devised a theory of special relativity, which explains why we would see superluminal motion, even though nothing is really moving faster than the speed of light. And the way you do that is pretty straightforward. It's something you can do as an undergraduate, and perhaps probably all of you did. I know I did, and I didn't ever imagine it would have application in anything I did. But anyway, okay, if you have a light bulb moving, here it's moving to the right, at about the speed of light, and it's emitting a photon in our direction when it's here, and then emitting another photon when it's there, of course, it's radiating in all directions, but I'm only interested in those photons that are going to get to me. You can see that it's sort of catching up to its own light. And so the interval between the arrival times of these two photons are closer together than they would be if the light bulb weren't moving in our frame. And if you work out the geometry, it's actually very straightforward to write down that the velocity you observe is beta sine theta over 1 minus beta cosine, where this is theta. So this is the fact that you see a shorter distance, you see the projected distance, but the dominant term is the lower one, you see a shorter time interval. So the speed gets faster than the speed of light for small angles. You can see that to get an apparent speed of 10C, you just need a bulk Lorentz factor of about 10. That means that 3C279, the one I showed you the map of, has emission coming from something moving at about 10 times, with a Lorentz factor of 10. Now, that's cute, but it also has some other ramifications. This is the beaming part of the relativistic motion. If I define a Doppler factor by this, this is how it's defined, but basically it's just roughly equal to the Lorentz factor for small angles. So when the motion is nearly along the line of sight, it's roughly equal to the Lorentz factor. I explained how the time interval is shorter, that you observe a time interval that's shorter than the rest frame time. The inverse of that is you observe blue-shifted emission. And the most important term is that you observe an intensity that goes as delta cubed times the rest frame intensity. If you like, derive that mathematically. It's mainly from the transformation of the solid angle, when you have one frame moving relativistically. But I like to show a picture because I never understood what all that stuff meant. This is a picture of relativistic beaming. Hang on. Time out. I'll just hold this. Okay. This is color-coded, so when the light bulb was at the purple spot, it emitted a wave, a spherical wave, which has now reached here. This is a photograph at a later time. When it got to the blue spot, it emitted this wave, and so on. And now the light bulb's over here. And you can see that in the light, as far as the light bulb's concerned, it's emitting isotropically. As far as we're concerned, it's sending all its light in the forward direction. So that's kind of a schematic of what's happening. And the reason that's important is because what it means is when there's an astronomical object which has an emitting region moving at the speed of light toward us, then it's enormously brighter than it really is. Okay? And that's the secret of blazars. They appear much more luminous than they are because they happen to be beamed at us. Okay? So they have a jet pointing at us. And also they have a jet pointing at some other part of the universe the other way, so maybe somebody has found them as a blazar. And there are also many objects in the sky, there have to be, which are randomly pointing away from us. And those we call radio galaxies. Now, the reason we know this picture is true, when I first started in this business, it was just a hypothesis. The reason we know it's true, or has to be true, is from gamma ray observations of the kind I showed you. With the EGRIT instrument, which is sensitive at GeV energies, about 50 or 60 blazars have been detected, mostly quasars, some BLAC objects. I'll tell you in a minute what... I'll tell you now. Okay, BLAC objects are the sort of the low luminosity form of blazars. They have very weak line emission, and they're just a little wimpier than a typical quasar. And these alphabet soup stands for the different names that get given to blazars when they're high luminosity, which include optically violently variable quasars, highly polarized quasars, flat spectrum radio quasars. They're all different names, but they more or less mean blazars. Okay, anyway, if you have a gamma ray, first of all, the gamma ray luminosity observed from most of these blazars was at least as luminous, and in some cases 10, 100, even 1,000 times more luminous than the rest of the emission that was observed. So a number of us who spent years figuring out blazars from looking at the radio through X-ray emission were missing more or less 99% of the energy output from some of these objects. Okay, but the main point here is if they are both luminous and highly variable, in other words, they have this very high luminosity, very short variability time scales, then you know they're relativistically beamed. And the argument is that the optical depth to pair production has to be less than one. Otherwise, the gamma rays would make pairs and the energy would cascade down to X-rays and you would never see gamma rays from blazars. So we know that the intrinsic optical depth to pair production is less than one. You can write down that the optical depth roughly goes as the compactness parameter, which is something like the luminosity over the transmission. I hope this recording is worth it. Wait a minute. Okay. I really am sorry. Okay. The luminosity goes as delta to the fourth, and the dimension is, if you're doing it by variability time, goes as 1 over delta. So you get 5 powers of this Doppler factor, making your apparent compactness much bigger than it really is. Okay? And when you work out the comparison between the apparent compactness and this fact that it has to actually be less than 1, you get lower limits of the Doppler factor, which are a few. In other words, these sources have to be beamed or we wouldn't see gamma rays. So it sort of confirmed the beaming hypothesis. Okay, so we have a picture. What I just told you is basically this, that blazars are AGN with a black hole and jets, and the one coming toward us is what makes us see it as a blazar. If we looked from the side, we would call it a radio galaxy. I'll show you some pictures of radio galaxies. But this implies that blazars are the same thing as radio galaxies. They should have the same host galaxies. They should sit in similar environments. And the numbers should work out correctly. I won't talk about that today, but they do. And this is called the unification hypothesis. Okay, this is a famous but fairly typical radio galaxy, Cygnus A, a powerful radio galaxy. This is a picture made in radio light. The center is here, and twin beams of relativistic particles are streaming out and feeding these extended radio lobes You can see the jet on this side just barely, which terminates in a hot spot here, which is moving relativistically, still expanding into the intergalactic medium. And if you, I don't think I can even see it, but if you look on a computer screen, you can also see a counterjet, which is weaker, which goes in the opposite direction. So the reason the jets are faint, of course, is because they're beaming their radiation to somebody over there. They're more or less in the plane of the sky, so they're very faint. If you dial down their intrinsic power, these jets are quite powerful. If you dial down the power, you get something that looks like more like this, and this is even not that faint. I'm going to lapse into jargon probably inadvertently. So the previous kind, the powerful radio galaxy, is called an FR1 radio galaxy, and FR2, and this is called FR1. All things in astronomy are type 1 and 2, and radio galaxies are no exception. So anyway, here's the center. You see a jet only on one side. It's much more diffuse, and it sort of peters out before it ever makes a giant radio lobe. These weaker radio galaxies are the ones that make BLX when they point at us. And the more powerful radio galaxies are the ones that make quasars when they point at us. And the main difference between the two is the line emission, and it's simply a consequence of the fact that more luminous objects have more luminous line emission regions. Okay, so, I could have said. Anyway, those jets, by the way, the reason you only saw the jet on one side is because it's still superluminal. It's still moving at faster than the speed of light all the way out to several kiloparsecs. And so it's Doppler boosted on that one side. In that particular case, it's at about 40 degrees to line of sight, so it's something like this. And we're only seeing that jet that's coming toward us, and we don't see the one that's going away. But you know the other one was there because you saw the diffuse emission once it had sort of stopped. Right. Okay. All right, well, this is the, as I said, this is the unification hypothesis, just to sort of fill in the details of AGN unification. This is a schematic picture of what we think the center of an AGN looks like, a black hole with an accretion disk around it, which is funneling in material, allowing it to lose angular momentum so it can accrete onto the black hole. There are clouds of gas orbiting the black hole. If they're close in, they're called broad line clouds because they're moving fast and they make broad emission lines. If they're far out, we call them narrow emission line clouds because they're moving slowly and the emission lines are narrow. Sorry for the descriptive. Yeah, okay. And then surrounding this whole very luminous central source is some kind of obscuration. It's shown here as a donut. It might be a torus. It might be some kind of warped disk. But it's basically shielding the center from some lines of sight. And Ski Antonucci really came up with this picture a long time ago now. Okay, about 5% of all AGN have relativistic jets coming out, and those are the radio loud objects. We don't know why some AGN form radio sources and some do not. That is one of the key questions we're now trying to figure out. But some black holes make jets. They stream out relativistically, and they either peter out, like their FR1 sources, or they make giant radio lobes. The question was, is there any link to rotation? There are theories that if the black hole is spinning, it can make jets, and that the radio quiet objects have unspinning black holes. But there are problems with that idea because any amount of accretion should spin the black hole up, and so it's not clear why they wouldn't all be spinning. My personal idea is that all AGN make jets, and that the radio quiet ones are just so weak they never make it out through the. Particularly, it's radio quiet AGN are much more often found in spiral galaxies, which are gas rich, and so it fits with the idea that the jets get quenched. But then it doesn't explain why you never see radio sources in luminous radio sources in spirals. Okay, now. I showed you the picture of what we think an AGN is. Now the plan, well, first of all, why do I work on blazars? Why are blazars interesting? They're sort of a curiosity. They're sort of a manifestation of special relativity in real life, if you want to tell your students that. But so what? Well, the reason they're interesting is that because the jets are pointed at us, they are magnified by basically a million times what you'd see if they're in the plane of the sky. And so if you'd like to study the emission from jets, surely it's better to look at one where nature has kindly magnified the emission by a factor of 10 to the 6th. So you have detectable flux. So that's why we look at blazars, to understand where how these jets are formed, how the energy is extracted from the black hole, what the emission processes are, and so on. Actually, what we really want to understand is the black hole. But we're a long way from that. We're kind of working backwards. Somehow black holes know how to make jets, and by the way, they do this on galactic scales as well. It's a pretty common phenomenon in over 8 orders of magnitude in the mass of a black hole, which is pretty astonishing. So we don't understand how that works, so the first step would be to understand what the jets are like. What are they made of? What are their energetics? What's their structure? And so on. And so that's the goal of studying blazars, and now I'll tell you what we know about that part. And I'll do that by talking about the multi-wavelength spectra and variability. This is 3C279 again, a spectrum from radio through gamma ray energies, 10 decades in frequency. And the y-axis is nu f nu, so it shows the power per logarithmic bandwidth, meaning a peak in this plot tells you where most of the energy is coming out. Okay, so you see fairly clearly two bumps, a bump here and another component here. These are the EGRIT measurements that I referred to earlier, and it's shown at several different epochs. I showed you that the gamma ray flux is highly variable, so you can see it varies by a factor of 30 in just these 4 observations. You don't see anything in certain gaps because the instruments that we have can't observe there. So I want you to notice a couple things about this. First of all, for this object, at least during these times when the gamma rays were detected, most of the energy comes out in the gamma ray by a factor of about 10. There's more energy in the gamma ray, except possibly when it's faint. This first component is fairly well understood as to be synchrotron radiation, which is, of course, electrons being accelerated in the magnetic field. The peak here probably has to do with some characteristic electron energy, because the frequency of synchrotron photons goes as gamma squared B, where gamma is the Lorentz factor of the electron. So that's what's happening here. And you notice there's much more variability where toward higher frequencies, meaning higher electron energies. And that fits, because losses go as the energy squared. Okay, same here. This is perhaps a constant scattered component, where the same electrons are scattering some photons. There's some debate over which photons. It doesn't matter too much. But anyway, they're producing this peak, and this would be probably the same characteristic electron energy. Okay, this is a very luminous blazar. A low luminosity blazar, meaning a BLAC object, looks very similar. I just want to show one example. Carrying 421. Same radio through gamma rays, nu f nu. You see again two components, okay? But here the heights are more similar. In other words, roughly equal energies coming out in each. Also notice that the peak here is at in X-ray energy range. I didn't actually point out previously, but the other peak was down in the infrared. Okay, so the lower luminosity ones have much higher energy peaks, and similarly, these detections are at TeV gamma ray energies. They're done with Cherenkov detectors from the ground, which look at the interaction of the gamma rays with the atmosphere. They look at the blue light. So both peaks have shifted to the right. The ratio is closer to 1, perhaps even as little as a tenth of the energies coming out in gamma rays. Okay. So our picture of what's happening to make this emission, first of all, is shown in this little cartoon. We have a synchrotron-emitting jet, which has a bulk motion. Of course, the electrons have their own individual Lorentz factors, which are something like 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 6, something like that. But they have a bulk motion to the right with a Lorentz factor of something like 10. Okay? And those little electrons are happily emitting synchrotron photons. And they're also encountering photons from the accretion disk, maybe UV light, maybe X-rays from a corona around the accretion disk. They're seeing broadline emission from the broadline clouds, so Lyman alpha photons. And depending on the luminosities involved, different ones can dominate the Compton scattered emission. For example, in low luminosity blazars, where there's very little line emission, probably the gamma rays are produced by the synchrotron self-Compton, or SSC method, where these electrons see their own photons and scatter them up to gamma rays. But in a luminous blazar, where the line emission is quite strong, then these photons impinging on the jet are scattered up to gamma rays, and you get much more gamma ray emission. And you get, I'm almost done with this sort of basic explanation of what's going on. There's one more little tidbit you need, and that is that there's a continuous range of blazar spectra going from low luminosity, sorry, this is now nu L nu, so absolute luminosity versus frequency, for five sets of blazars divided by radio luminosity. This into five bins of radio luminosity. And when you plot their spectra, this is the kind I showed you second. Okay, a blue blazar peaking in the X-ray and the TEV. And the kind I showed you, 3279, is the red type, which is peaking in the infrared and in GEV energies. And for the red blazars, not only are the peaks at lower energy, but there are more gamma rays compared to the synchrotron radiation than in the blue blazars. And the one other fact that you need to know, which isn't on this plot, is that as you go up in luminosity, the line emission luminosity goes up. So that leads us to the following sort of paradigm for, sometimes it's easier to see. Two components, the two bumps in the spectra, when they vary together. Okay, so they're obviously related. That's what makes us think it's the same electron producing both. There's synchrotron plus at least self-Compton and probably external Compton in many sources. And the trends are, as the luminosity goes up, the peak frequencies decrease, the ratio of gamma rays to synchrotron increases, and the external photon density increases. Okay, so the idea is that as you go up in luminosity, you have more cooling of the electron, because they encounter more soft photons, which they scatter to gamma rays. And so the mean electron energy is lower. And that means the peak frequency of the synchrotron emission is lower. So high luminosity in the gamma rays, you're dominated by external Compton, scattering of the line emission. And at low luminosity, you're dominated by synchrotron self-Compton. So that's our current picture of what we see from blazars. And if you believe that picture, and there are some concerns about it, I mean, it's not rock solid yet, then you can interpret the emission you see with those simple models and figure out what the electron densities are, the magnetic field strength, and ultimately the jet power. So that's the current locus of activity in blazar research. And now it gets kind of laborious because the emission, as you saw, spans a large frequency range. It's variable over a large frequency range. So if you want to know what's going on, you have to actually observe with many different telescopes. And I show here an example of one of our earliest really good multi-wavelength campaigns, which is over a period of about 10 days in May 94. What I show here in blue is X-ray emission. This is extreme ultraviolet emission, so about 100 angstroms, and this is the UV emission from a particular blazar. This is a blue blazar, meaning the X-ray, all of this stuff is synchrotron emission. It's all in the first component, okay, spectral component. So you see, first of all, that the X-rays are highly variable, and you see in particular a very well-resolved flare there. the EUV emissions kind of noisy, but you can also see a peak here about a day later and a peak here much broader about a day after that. If you take very simple synchrotron theory and inject electrons at high energy and let them cool, the lag that you see of the low energy photons behind the high energy photons should be roughly as the cooling time at the lower energy. And so if you take a 2-day cooling time, you can work out what the electron energies are and so on. And it all works very nicely. So that was kind of a nice confirmation of the notion that it's synchrotron radiation. Now, of course, real life is more complicated, thanks. And when we got better data, these now are some multi-wavelength light curves from 2 years ago of another blue blazar. Let me explain what we have here first. This is 10 days, again, extreme ultraviolet, soft X-ray, hard X-ray, and this is now TEV emission, so this is in the second component. The rest of this is synchrotron radiation, but this is the constant scattered radiation. Here we don't have anything as simple as an isolated flare. We have lots of flares which are very well correlated between soft and hard X-rays, and even with the extreme ultraviolet, if you can sort of let your eye do the analysis. And okay, the amplitude increases with energy, just as you could maybe see from the spectra. The tail, the high energy tail of the spectrum waggles more because the electron, the high energy electrons lose their energy faster. And you can also see a sort of rough correlation with the TEV, but the statistics there are poor. However, if you look in detail at these data, you find the picture's a little more complicated than we could have hoped. This now is just showing the X-ray light curve here. This is the same light curve you saw before. But now what I show here is the lag of the soft photons behind the hard photons. Okay? So if it were like the first example I showed you with the sharp flare, the lag would be up here, actually much higher, but at several days, up here always positive. And what you see is that the lag goes positive and negative depending on the epoch. So in some cases the soft photons lag the hard, in others the hard photons lag the soft. So this is actually, let's see. You can sort of explain it qualitatively. The soft lag is what I said before, it's a cooling. And the hard lag would be if the shocks are weak and so you're accelerating the particles more slowly. That is, it takes time for the electrons to reach high energy. So in that case, you would pass through the softer part sooner. You would make the soft photons sooner. So it's some combination of those effects probably happening, but it means that it's very complicated to interpret. But there is one very clean and nice result from those data, and that is the time scale of variability. This is a structure function made from the light curves I showed you. Okay, for those of you who aren't familiar with structure functions, you basically calculate the amount of power between data separated by a fixed lag. So at, say, a lag of a day, you take every pair of data separated by one day and see how correlated they are. And then you do that for every lag. And so you produce a curve, which is related to the power density spectrum. It's just and the index is one less. So in purple here are the oscillite curves I showed you. This is the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer All-Sky Monitor data. And you see very clearly a knee in the spectrum, which has actually not been seen before this in any blazar. And a sharp break in the structure function indicates a characteristic time scale. So there is some kind of characteristic time scale, meaning excess power, if you like. I mean, most of the power is on something a little less than a day, but more than a few hours. And this is the EUVE structure function, which is sort of similar, but less power because it has bigger error bars. Okay, so what have we learned from this unresolved jet emission? I would say we've learned that the electron injection is complex and that we aren't going to come up with any simple, quick answers. So we're continuing to do this kind of monitoring to try to get constraints on the jet, but this is I would say this is a work in progress, and I don't have any beautiful answer to tell you yet. In fact, I'll just moan and groan about what hard work it is. Okay. Now I'm going to switch gears, what will look like entire switch of gears, to a different topic. So, but we'll come back at the end.
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
What's the state for evidence of any variant on the jet?
Oh, that's a good question. What do we know? Well, we know if there are baryons in the jet, then the energy requirements are much higher, right? Because the kinetic energy goes up by the factor of 2,000. But we don't actually know which it is yet, whether there are protons in the jet or electrons and positrons. One way of worrying about that, this is a complicated question. You can ask how many cold electrons there are, and if you make the assumption that the protons have the same power as the electrons, that they have the same Lorentz factor as the electrons, we can put a limit on how many cold electrons there are. So we can put a limit on how many cold protons under that assumption. But that's the best we can do, and that's not very good.
Okay. But in terms of the emission, is it possible if there are protons against
an
ion?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yes, right. I guess I didn't answer your question directly. There are other models for making this gamma ray emission, which involve accelerating protons to very high energy, and then they decay, and you see the residual emission from the electrons. There's nothing to rule those models out at present. The only thing I would say is that you have to tune the parameters a little bit, because you have to make it be just the right generations of electrons producing the emission we see. Any other questions? Okay, so now I'm going to tell you about something I did with HST, Hubble Space Telescope, and actually most of the work was done by my postdoc Ricardo Scarpa and also my graduate student Matthew O'Dowd. We did a large survey of BLAC objects, which I remind you are these low luminosity jets, and I also remind you they come in red and blue, because later some of my data will show red and blue, and it actually makes no difference. We find there's no difference between them, but later when I say red and blue, it's because the red are a little higher power than the blue. Okay. Anyway, these are our initial plan was to try to sort of verify unification, that the host galaxies were the same as the host galaxies of radio galaxies. That's now pretty firm, so. We also are looking at the question of how do they compare to normal galaxies, which don't have obvious black holes in the centers. And what I show here are the results, which I'm going to show you more or less a view graph for each. But it's worth saying them ahead of time. First of all, we observed 110 BLAC objects with HST. And if you've tried to get Hubble Space Telescope time, you know that that's an amazing achievement, and I will tell you my secret, but it won't do you any good. My secret was to be lucky enough to apply for snapshot time in a cycle in cycle six. Snapshot means short observations which get slotted in to available less than one orbit amounts of time that are free in the schedule, so they're kind of opportunistic observations. And in cycle five, we undersubscribed the snapshots by a lot. So in cycle six, first of all, they started it 6 months early, and second of all, they accepted a whole boatload of snapshots. So that's why I got all my time. But it won't work for you. Okay. So we took these 132 targets from four complete samples, four X-ray selected, one radio selected, and one optically selected, spanning redshift out to just a bit beyond redshift one. We detected host galaxies in essentially all of them that were at redshift less than a half, and only about a quarter at higher redshift, and that's because these are snapshots. They're less than an orbit. They're too short to see even quite luminous host galaxies at high redshift. The results are that they all sit in elliptical galaxies, which are very luminous, about a magnitude brighter than the characteristic luminosity of ellipticals, which goes by the name M star. They have a mu-e-re relation, which I'll explain later what that is, just like normal ellipticals. They do match radio galaxies as expected. There's no connection that we can see between the AGN, the nuclear luminosity, and the galaxy luminosity, none. And this is contrary to some other reports, which I'll try to address. And finally, we find that the host galaxies of BLX and quasars, and indeed normal galaxies, look absolutely the same. So now I'll try to convince you that that's what our data show. Okay. First, just a glimpse of some data. This is one particular object at a redshift of 0.664. For those of you who aren't familiar with the HST Wide-Field Planetary Camera 2, this is what an image looks like. There are four chips, and the resolution here is twice the resolution of the other one, so the field of view is half. So you get this chevron shape as a result. We always put our target in the center of the planetary camera chip, so we have the highest resolution, and then we get the field surrounding it in the other chips, and that's important for studying the environment. In fact, this one looks to be in a particularly rich cluster of galaxies. You see these galaxies here. There are a lot of galaxies around this particular BLX. Okay. Blowing up the images just a little, I'll show you what we've typically got. Here are three examples. Across the top, just the central part of the PC image for three blazars, three BLX. And at the bottom, I show you what they look like when we subtract the central point source. Okay, so we take out the nuclear light. And the reason it's important to use HST, I guess it goes without saying, is because of the high spatial resolution, this extremely bright nucleus, which from the ground tends to swamp the galaxy light, here is confined to a tenth of an arc second or less, and so you can subtract it out and see what's left, which here is nothing. You don't see any host galaxy. Here's a sort of a weak detection, and here's a booming detection. And then we studied the host galaxies to see what their properties were. We also have data from the NICMOS camera, which was an infrared detector that operated for about a year. It has to be cryogenically cooled, and the cryogen was leaking, so it didn't last very long, but it will come back this coming cycle. We found that the host galaxies were quite round, so we did a one-dimensional analysis, and that means taking the azimuthally average surface brightness profile, shown here as a purple line, and then fitting it with a point source, which is the red line, and a galaxy, which is the blue line. Okay, and then we do chi-square, and we get the best fit parameters, and we get error bars, which not all astronomers do. That was mean of me, but there aren't too many astronomers in the audience, so I'm safe. Okay, and then we get the parameters of the galaxy. Now, first of all, we fit them with ellipticals and with exponential disks, which is characteristic of spirals, and in all cases, the ellipticals were better fits. So then what I'm going to show you are just the parameters from elliptical fits. First, how bright are they? This is the magnitude of the host galaxy versus redshift for all of our BLX objects in red and blue. And the upper limits are shown here. You see that at high redshift, above a redshift of a half, we have a lot of upper limits. Okay, but they're not terribly significant because the exposures are short. Okay, so the first thing is that between red and blue, you don't see any difference. Okay, they have equally identical host galaxies, even though the nuclei have different luminosity. Okay. The mean magnitude, absolute magnitude, is about -23.7. As I said, that's about a magnitude brighter than a typical elliptical. So these are very luminous ellipticals. If the stars were passively evolving and had formed at very high redshift, they should follow a track like this purple line. Okay, and we can't actually constrain that because we don't go to high enough redshift. But if we were able to get data out to redshift 1, we would be able to say something about it. Okay, I also show brightest cluster galaxies in yellow. These are the brightest galaxies in clusters of galaxies. So these are sort of the most luminous ellipticals known. And you can see the host galaxies are a bit below there, but almost as bright. And shown as blue stars, I hope you can see them, those are quasar host galaxies measured with HST. And you can see that they overlap exactly. The reason I've plotted it versus redshift is there are selection effects that can occur with redshift, but if you look at a given redshift, those shouldn't be there, and so you see that there's just a perfect match. And of course, quasars are intrinsically more luminous sources than BLX. Oh, whoops, I'm going the wrong way now. Okay, next point. Elliptical galaxies follow a very well-known relation between the surface brightness measured at some fiducial mark, the size, and the velocity dispersion. It's called the fundamental plane. We don't have any velocity dispersion information because we don't have spectra, but we can look at the projection of the fundamental plane onto the two dimensions of surface brightness versus effective radius. And that's what this plot is. It's called the mu-E-R-E plot, mu for surface brightness at the effective radius, and in magnitude, so that's a logarithmic scale, and this is a logarithmic scale. And the blue and red dots, again, are our data, our results for our host galaxies. And these lines, there are three lines here. I could have plotted more, but it gets very messy. But those are lines for different samples of galaxies, radio galaxies and normal ellipticals. And basically, our data lie right on top of the other data. So our host galaxies are absolutely normal ellipticals that follow the same fundamental relation as ellipticals that don't have active nuclei. Just to show you what the data, these are various radio galaxies, kind of all plotted one on top of the other, same thing. There's a similar scatter to what the plot I just showed, that's why I wanted to show this. Okay, what else? Well, one of our goals, as you recall, was to see if the BLX host galaxies look like radio galaxies, and which ones. So this is actually a classic plot for astronomers, but maybe it's not so familiar to everybody, of radio power versus host galaxy or versus galaxy magnitude. This plot was first made for just radio galaxies, which I've plotted here as 1 and 2. 1 when they're the low luminosity FR1 type, 2 when they're the high luminosity FR2 type. And then on top of that, I put our BLX host galaxies and the quasar host galaxies. And so you can see, I think, pretty clearly that the BLX belong to the FR1s, unambiguously, and the quasars belong to the FR2s. That actually is in dispute, but it's indisputable in my view. Okay. We also wanted to ask whether the nuclear power, the central luminosity of the nucleus was related in any way to the host galaxy luminosity, because there have been reports of that. In particular, well, this is a result from McLeod and Ricci, which shows galaxy luminosity going up, nuclear luminosity here for a whole load of different kinds of AGN. But for their objects, which were 9 high luminosity quasars, they said they saw an envelope to the distribution such that if you had an extremely bright nucleus, it had to be in a very luminous galaxy. So we looked for this in our data and didn't find it. I'll show you the result. The blue and red, again, are our data. The green are some quasars, which were observed with HST. And there's no upper envelope. These lines are what you would expect if... let me explain this. Back up a half a step. Okay. It is observed in nearby galaxies that there are, for dynamical reasons, there are central black holes. Not active ones, but there are measured masses for black holes in normal galaxies nearby. There appears to be a crude relation between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the bulge or the elliptical galaxy. If you take that relation, mass black hole, and assume that the, and then say is that holds for an AGN and the AGN is radiating at the Eddington limit, you would get this relation between nuclear luminosity and host galaxy. And if it's a tenth Eddington or 0.01 Eddington, you get that. Okay. So we don't see the envelope, but it may be that it's an effect that happens at high luminosity and our objects are simply too low luminosity. But I would also say there are claims from other work that there is a correlation here and that everything is radiating at a tenth Eddington, and we don't see that. Yeah, that's a very good question. Beaming actually does affect this diagram because the apparent nuclear magnitude is related to beaming. However, it doesn't affect the previous diagram, you find it, for which we use extended radial power. And extended radial power is a measure of the power of the nucleus integrated over time, and you still don't see, you don't see that relation. It's a good question, though. We hope to de-beam things, but we have to get the right Lorentz factors first. And just to show, this is the same host galaxy versus nucleus, but now adding in radio galaxies. And here you can see the full effects of beaming. Radio galaxies, of course, have much weaker nuclei, but they have the same host galaxies. Okay, nearly done. Let's say a few more things. We have, for some of our objects, not 110, unfortunately, but for about a dozen, we have the H-band imaging from NICMOS, so very high quality, very high resolution imaging. And so we can look at the colors of the host galaxies and how they evolve over time. And this is the R-H color versus redshift of those 12 that we happen to be able to measure, except that for a couple of them wasn't good enough. Anyway, fine. Okay, and then some lines how the colors should change with redshift if there were star formation at 4 gigayears or 10 gigayears. And you see that we're just not sensitive to that, although we can tell that the stellar populations are very old. They're not 2 gigayears old or more recent. There's no recent star formation that we can detect. We can also look at color profiles. That is, within each galaxy, look at how the color changes with radius. So we can do that for 8 of our objects shown here. Here's the R-H color versus radius in kiloparsecs out to 20 kiloparsecs. And you can see in quite a few we have this gradient, which is also seen in normal ellipticals, such that they're bluer at the outside and redder at the inside. And that has something to do with how they formed and how the stars are evolving. So I've showed you how the host galaxies of BLX are absolutely normal ellipticals in every property that we are able to measure. And this is what I meant by the black hole galaxy connection. BLX have big, massive black holes, and they're accreting and forming jets and so on. And normal galaxies sit there with maybe a black hole in the center or maybe not. And so the first conclusion is there's not much effect of the nucleus on the galaxy. We have a range of, between the BLX and the quasars, a range of orders of magnitude in power, central power of the nucleus, and there's no difference in the host galaxy whatsoever. So one idea is that galaxies all have black holes in them, and that the black holes and the galaxies formed at more or less the same time. And a sort of intriguing, but not conclusive, but intriguing piece of evidence for that is shown here. For a moment, look at the top curve. This is the star formation rate versus redshift. These data points are measured star formation rates, basically adding up the blue light you see from galaxies, so in galaxies. And the black curve is an estimate of the black hole mass formation rate measured from the light of quasars converted to a mass through an assumed efficiency. So both of them are kind of uncertain things, but okay. And here they're not corrected for extinction, and then down here we've corrected the star formation rate for extinction. These came from Mauro Giavalisco and Chuck Seidel. Okay, the main thing is that as you look back into the early universe, the star formation rate goes way up, and the black hole formation rate goes way up, sort of similarly. Whether they peak similarly and whether this part of the curve is the same is the part that's not known. But what I'm speculating is perhaps they form together and all galaxies have black holes and only some of them are active, or only more likely they are all active sometime but only some small fraction of the time. Okay, so that's the main point, and I'm just going to summarize what I told you so you can take it home and remember. The summary, blazars are relativistically beamed jets. That means they're just like all other radio loud AGN, but they're a nice laboratory for studying the jet. They emit synchrotron and Compton scattered radiation, we believe, although not definitively on the Compton scattered part of that. And the trends with luminosity can be explained as increased cooling due to increased ambient photon densities. The flaring is complex, but will eventually, we hope, tell us about the energetics of the jets. The host galaxies are normal but luminous ellipticals. We confirm the unification hypothesis in detail, and we imply a sort of a grander unification with all galaxies, that both those that are known to host black holes, that are AGN, and those that are only suspected to host black holes. Thank you. Okay, if you, for example, can observe superluminal motion, then you have a guess for what the bulk Lorentz factor is. You need both the Lorentz factor and the angle, and you need some other constraints. So you can also do it from, if you have the jet-counter-jet ratio or even a limit on that, you can get various limits on what the beaming factor might be. So we want to do at least that much. It's not very, it's hard to get exactly what it is. Well, of the 110, there are only about 50-ish that we need to do, 50, 60, and probably about half of those have measured superluminal velocities. And from the gamma ray detection and the ratio of the two peaks, you can also get a limit if you believe that's constant scattered radiation. That's a good question. It depends on luminosity, but if you ask the question, if I look out how many galaxies are active, the number is something like 1%. And then if you ask of how many active galaxies do have radio emission, it's about 5 or 10% of that. So it's a small number. But it goes up as you go to high luminosity. In the higher luminosity galaxies, the fractions are higher. Moriko. Good question. There are two known superluminal sources in radio quiet AGN. Yeah. And there are also some circumstantial arguments. That the superluminal ones come from Catherine Blondell and her group. There's also some circumstantial evidence from Heino Falke and his collaborators suggesting that many of the radio quiet objects have a sort of an excess of radio emission because of beaming. But it's not directly observed in each one. That's a really good question. probably around a Gauss, plus or minus two orders of magnitude. In normal galaxies, we don't have many measures of the magnetic field at all. I guess we have it from interstellar. I don't even know. Mordecai probably would know what the fields are. Yeah, Ellen. Yeah. But the thing I quoted was about just the magnetic field in the jet itself. And that probably comes from magnetic fields close to the black hole, which are threading the disk and then somehow help collimate and form the jet. But we aren't actually measuring them down where that's happening, where they have to be stronger. We're measuring them a little farther out. Yeah, it's closely related because many of the objects they were studying were blazars. And what they were effectively modeling was the expansion of the jet, because most of the radio emission comes from the extended jet, actually, extended in terms of of where the X-rays are coming from. The X-rays come from farther in. So that's why this expanding synchrotron model sort of works when you're at low frequency radio waves. It does become optically thin first at one energy, then it propagates. Yes, yes, they are. And those radio measurements, if you try to model the spectra that I showed with a simple homogeneous synchrotron source, you fail by a lot to produce all the radio. You miss most of it. And what that is saying is the most compact part of the source is producing the X-rays and the gamma rays, but not much radio, and most of the radio is coming from a more extended region. I mean, directly comparing the two curves. Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I don't know. I never heard anyone say that. That's very interesting. Yeah. Not at the beach. Yeah. You mean at the very long time? You're talking about the very end of it. Yeah. That has to bend over sometime so it converges, because presumably these sources don't random walk to arbitrary intensities. But we tend not to have observed for long enough times to have good light curves in order to measure it out there.